Mary Garrett, True Talk 800 AM.
It was on this date in 1973, that's 29 years ago, that my next guest went down to the Sarah Land Police Station in Alabama to answer some questions about a stolen truck. He was 17 years old at the time, and he did not return home for 27 years and 9 months. Welcome back. I'm Mary Sterrett. You're listening to True Talk 800 AM. It's 3:06. Glad to have you along. I was alerted to the story of Michael and Becky Pardue and wanted to share the story with you, lest you think that things are a whole lot different in this country than they actually are. Michael and Becky, nice to have you with us.
Thank you.
All right, Michael, why don't you tell us the story of what happened that day in May in 1973?
Well, the day actually started about this time, 29 years ago, trying to impress a young girl who was known to have some very extraordinary favors. One of the things she needed was some help locating a car. My car had a flat tire. I tried to elicit the aid of a friend, an older friend who was 21. He's real low mentality, low IQ. But he was older and had a car, so we went to his house trying to get his help to find her car, and that would then put me in her good graces, I hope. When he refused, we attempted to, and did steal two tires, and when those didn't fit my car, then we stole a pickup truck. John, the older fella, refused to go with us. He didn't want to have anything to do with anything illegal. We went and tried to find her vehicle, could not. Wound up getting back at the truck getting stuck around 2 a.m. in the morning, trying to locate her car. Stole another vehicle, a Volkswagen, in order to get transportation back to the motel where the older friend was staying. And went in, related our little annex. He was really appalled. He was kind of upset, you know, because we was involving him indirectly. At that point, you know, I'd been made a big fool of with the girl. I haven't been able to accomplish anything except embarrass myself a little bit. So I was relegated to go out and spend the rest of the night in my friend's car while she stayed inside the room with my friend. Next morning, I got up and was taken home by my older friend, and he took her home. My grandmother was very upset with me because I didn't have my car. And being a 17-year-old, not well-educated, my mother had been killed by my father the previous year. He was in prison. I was not emotionally very stable, more delinquent than anything. I responded when she asked where my car was by telling her it had been stolen. And because that would then get me off the hook for the fact that the car was broke down on the side of the road, you know, and all kinds of things like that. She was very upset about the fact the car was not there. And by the way, I paid $75 for it. You know, it wasn't a brand new car or anything. And I bought it for money I'd earned myself, but she was really upset with me because I wasn't meeting my responsibilities as she saw it. As a man, you know, even though at 17, I was considered that by her. And I don't mean to throw off on her. She's a good lady. She's just doing what most Southern ladies of her age and her gender do, you know. They make, you know, the young man of the family have to stand up and cut the mustard or not. So when I called Sarah Land Police and I reported my car stolen, I went in and went to bed. I was woke up about 3-4 hours later by the Sarah Land Police calling and asking to speak with me. Said they had recovered my car and they would like for me to come to Sarah Land Police Station about the car. I informed them I had no way to get there. A neighbor of my grandmother's was there at the house, heard the conversation. She said, Mike, I can't take you all the way there, but I can carry you halfway. So I told the police officers that. They said, all right, we'll meet you there at the city line. It's two little small cities. My friend, my next-door neighbor, carried me up there, dropped me off. Shortly, the police picked me up, put me in the front seat of the car, chattering with me. I was under no suspicion or anything at that point of any wrongdoing. I was taken to Sarah Land Police Station, carried into a small room that they kind of used for storage as well as, I guess, a little desk. Kept there for, in my memory it seems, for quite a long time. It probably was no more than an hour. But for me, alone in there, it was just quite long. The door burst open, literally just pushed open very violently, very quickly. Three very large men, all of them in excess of 6 feet tall, wearing suits, come in. Two of them immediately started crowding me, getting very close to me, sitting down. At the time, I weighed about 130 pounds. I was about 5'9", real slender and small. They started throwing things at me. Why'd you blow his head off? What are you, some kind of, you know, using all wild profanities and pushing me a little bit, you know, by their presence and feeding me details, saying, you know, why'd you shoot him in the head? You know you denied his family the last look at him that they'll ever have? Where's the shotgun? We know you used it. How come you had to shoot him just this way? Where's the money at? We know you took $58. Why did you take this $58? Ain't a man's life worth more than that? And this continued for quite a while, you know. And at one point, you know, I was so frightened, I hadn't said a word at that point. Probably as long as 20 or 30 minutes for this barrage going on, them getting on me, sometimes actually spitting on me with their violent, you know, vocal outburst. The other cop, who had been relatively quiet, he is remarkably resembles my father in his physical demeanor, his size, and his colorations and stuff. I mean, you could look at the two pictures of my father and Bill Travis and see almost brothers. And his voice and tone of voice was very remarkably similar. And he said in the voice, you know, y'all boys just back off just a minute here, you know. Michael will help you out just a little bit, and y'all just have to give him a little space here, you know. And he started feeding me, saying, you know, I was a tough guy. I was real respected in the criminal community. People looked up to me, and they were afraid of me, and all these kind of things, you know. One thing led to another, and I made a violent outburst, you know. That kept pushing. It got back very, very confrontational, threatening, pressing for about maybe another up to 45 minutes or so. And finally, I just told one of them, you know, because he got right in my face and said, why you little blanky blank blank, you know, all to do this and this and this to you, you know? And I said, look, you know, if you ain't careful, I'll do to you what I've already done. And everything stopped.
Oh.
Everybody got dead quiet. The two left the room. Then Travis walked out. A few minutes later, Travis came back by himself and escorted me into the chief of police's office, where the chief of police and four or five other police officers were in there. But those particular two of the initial three were gone. At this point, it became a game. I found out that if I said something like that, they would get off of me. They would stop the threat. They would stop pushing me.
But you just admitted to a murder you didn't commit.
I was raised in the southern Alabama to believe that the police were always right.
But certainly you knew in this case that you didn't commit the murder.
Precisely. And to me, it was the admissions were simply to get me some breathing space. For the next 2 or 3 hours, I sat down there and refused to do anything. I said, look, I was just joking. I wasn't serious, you know. And then after about 3 hours of that, it got very violent. Then they said, look, you know, started cursing me, pushing me, threatening physically. Look, you done said what it is. We know you did this. You did this, this, and this. And they started throwing photographs down in front of me, started talking with me sitting in the room, saying, well, when he walked in the room, he had, in this place, he had to do it just like this. And they'd look over to me and say, now, didn't you? Well, if I said yes, there were no more threats. If I said no, they started to try to hurt me. It got later on in the night, probably in the first 12 hours there, they started actually pushing me, putting their hands on me, grabbing me, you know, pushing me hard in chairs when I would refuse to cooperate.
Well, let's stop right there. Our guest is Michael Pardue, and he's telling us a story. And 29 years ago, May of 1973 to the day, he went down to the Saraland, Alabama police station to answer some questions about a stolen truck. And as we'll find out, it was not for 27 years and 9 months, that he was able to return home. We'll take a short break. For those of you who are interested in checking out the website, you can go to michaelpardue.com, or check out another website, freeingtheinnocent.com. And on it, you'll hear about a book that he and his wife, Becky, have written, Freeing the Innocent, How We Did It, a handbook for the wrongfully convicted. We'll continue our discussion here on True Talk 800 AM. I'm Mary Stead.
You could use some help around the house. Think about it. The grass needs mowing, you need to paint that downspout, and that stuff in the backyard needs to be hauled away. Here's a great idea. Hire the Teen Challenge workforce. The wages you pay them help offset the cost of their stay in Teen Challenge's residential discipleship program. With Crisis the Center, this program has been incredibly successful in helping men and women overcome their addictions to drugs and alcohol. But they need your help. The Teen Challenge workforce is made up of responsible men and women over 18 years old. And every job is supervised by a Teen Challenge staff pastor. It's easy to set up. Call Teen Challenge at 503-230-1910 and ask for Pastor Bill. That's 503-230-1910. The Teen Challenge workforce also does windows, house cleaning, minor remodeling, and assembly projects. Call Teen Challenge today at 503-230-1910 and ask for Pastor Bill.
True Talk, your station for positive programming 24 hours a day. True Talk, 800 AM.
Looking for the best interest rate in today's mortgage market? How about 4 7/8? That's today's best interest rate from Agape Home Mortgage, the mortgage company you can trust to have your best interest in mind. If you need an extra low payment now and are planning on moving or refinancing in 3 to 5 years, this adjustable rate mortgage is ideal. The rate is fixed at 4 7/8 for 3 years and becomes a 1-year adjustable rate mortgage after that. The APR is only 5.75. This best interest rate is available only through Agape Home Mortgage for a limited time. So call 503-243-LOAN right now to lock in. Remember, there's no fee to get pre-approved, and you can save an additional $250 by applying online at Agape's website, fastapproval.com. Call Agape Home Mortgage and let them find the best interest rate for you. Call 503-243-LOAN. That's 243-LOAN. Remember, 4 7/8 is a limited time offer, so call today. Agape Home Mortgage, the mortgage company with your best interest in mind.
Today on the Michael Medved Show,
a Harvard law professor has dedicated his life to securing constitutional rights for animals. We'll talk to him next time on the Michael Medved Show.
Listen for Michael Medved, weekdays at 4 on True Talk, shining a light on truth, justice, and the American dream. All for 6 1/4 an hour. Mary Sterrett, True Talk 800 AM.
It started in May of 1973, exactly 29 years ago, and for the next 27 years and 9 months, my guest Michael Pardue lost his freedom. Welcome back. This is True Talk 800 AM, and we're talking to Michael Pardue and his wife, Becky, finding out what happened on that day that he went down to the Saraland, Alabama police station to answer some questions about a stolen truck. As a 17-year-old, he was not exactly savvy in the way of good cop, bad cop, wound up sort of admitting to a crime that he did not commit, a murder, a rather gruesome murder, and then for 27 years and 9 months tried to prove he's innocent. I'm sure, Michael, you can understand that people at this point are saying, well, you just admitted to a crime. Can you blame the cop for then proceeding the way you do when someone admits to guilt?
Well, the tactics that's being used here against me is something very common and very unacceptable in this country. A cop wants something, and these are, and first, let me paraphrase here, these are those few, and there are very few, fortunately, in this country, who take advantage of that badge. The majority of our law enforcement officers are very good and honorable men. But we're addressing the minute few who take this to heart. For example, in this man in our case, he was already in severe trouble for using excessive force and brutality in over 100 cases. He had a reputation of having a dead body and a confession and no physical evidence. He was just a very, very poor example of law enforcement. For me, I was typical of an abusive family raised child in southern Alabama. It didn't matter what truth was, it's whatever my father wanted. If he wanted me to admit that I knocked the window out, even though I was at school when the window of the house got broken, if I didn't want to be beaten, I admitted to breaking the window. This is very common, and those bad police officers know this. And they use these tactics to continue to push. And for me, he found out where to manipulate and how to manipulate me. After 78 hours of this, which is nonstop, you can imagine 78 hours of somebody constantly threatening you, pushing you, feeding you information. And the only respite you're getting is when you're cooperative. Deep down inside of you, you're raised to believe in the integrity of the judiciary, of police officers, of our judges, and our prosecutors. So you feel a safety net sort of laying out there that if I survive this man and this prosecutor, then the court will sit down here and protect me. Yes, I'm going to go to jail. I'm going to suffer some consequences for the theft that I did. But these murders are a joke. It's a fairy tale. I am safe from that because people do not go to jail for things they don't do.
That's a very good point. And I think what we need to do, the bottom line in this whole story, Michael, is people go to jail all the time for things they didn't do.
They certainly do. In America right now, there's nearly 25,000, and that's very conservative. 25,000 people in this country today are incarcerated for something they had nothing to do with.
And the thing is all we have to do is look at the weekly, sometimes two, three times a week, convicts who, based on DNA evidence, are let out of prison. And if that's what we have caught, what about the years and years and years before this technology was available? And what about the crimes where DNA is not an element?
Well, Barry Sheck of the Innocence Project out of the University of Northwestern Illinois tells you and wrote a book about it. DNA only accounts for less than 15% of all false confession cases in the world today. And we just seen, just in January, 100 people released by DNA. So if that's 15% of those, look at the figure we're talking about right here. And how many have we executed in this country?
Well, that's why I'm no longer for capital punishment. And people say, well, how can you not be for capital punishment? How can you be when so many innocent people have died? And when you look at what law enforcement is capable of, to railroad, to get a conviction just to get a conviction, knowing that the real bad guy is out there.
Well, you know there's a second part to the horror story. It's not those officers that do the bad deeds. The officers that did my bad deeds, for the most part, were either discredited, sent to prison for other unrelated crimes and bad acts, and then over the long period of time, this 27 years, have died from cancer and all this kind of thing. In 1995, I finally won a new trial thanks to the efforts of my wife. Not the judicial system, not some attorney, not some glowing example of a judge, but because of the efforts of a woman who loved me.
All right, let's go on from that night when you were pummeled and wound up giving a false confession. What happened next?
After they had their confession, and what it was is a tape that they used, I was taken and placed in the most violent, most toughest prisons in this country. At the time, Alabama, if you're familiar with law or anything, Alabama was one of the few states the federal government eventually stepped in and took over in the early 70s because it was so deplorable, so horrible in here. I was sent there to the place where the electric chair was kept. It's called the Holdman Unit. Down there, I had one choice of survival. I was the youngest and smallest inmate in that institution for 4 years. I stayed the youngest inmate for another 2 years. I had one persona to assume. If I did not adopt the persona that I was a killer, I would have in myself been killed. By living that persona and seeing the deplorable situation, and I'm talking about going in where they feed you, called the mess hall or chow hall, they would serve you greens with maggots in it, and they would be alive. You have to sit down here and watch a man. The first day I came home, and a man's head was chopped off right next to me. And nobody arrested this guy. This guy stayed in population with me 4 more months and killed one other person.
Mm.
And the guards back then were not paid. They were in terror and fear of their lives. At one point, that prison went for 9 days that a guard never even come inside the cell block. People ran from that place. You run from an environment like that. You don't stay there. I don't care if you are guilty. It is horrible to stay in a place where every second you live in fear of your life and there's nobody to protect you.
And you didn't stay there, did you, Michael?
No, ma'am, I did not. Every opportunity that I could get away from there without harming anybody or causing any more criminal acts, I did.
Now, you went AWOL. You escaped 4 times?
3 times.
3 times you escaped. I can't say that I blame you. How is it that you were able to escape that many times?
And back then, it was quite easy. The first time, all it did was took a little bribe money, bribing an official who was an intermediary, give me a custody status that allowed me to be transferred away from Double Mac, and then you take advantage of the lesser security and just walk away, and that's exactly what I did.
And how long were you able to stay out?
I was only out, just able to stay out that time about 2.5 days.
Mm, and you were caught again.
I was caught again because I had not committed any further criminal acts. I didn't have any money. I didn't have any identification. I was in the same clothes. I hadn't broken in or stolen anything.
So you were sent back, and every time you were sent back, they added more time to your sentence.
Yes, ma'am, they did. In the last time, they gave me life without the possibility of parole.
So you figured at this point in time, there's just no way I'll ever see the light of day.
Until I met my wife, I was firmly and absolutely convinced that I was going to die in prison for something I hadn't did. I wound up educating myself. I started studying the law, trying to find some hope. And for a number of years, that gave me hope because I was helping some other guys get out of prison. But every time I got to really seriously looking at my own situation and looking at the judiciary as a whole, I knew that by myself, I would die in there. There was no hope for me.
Enter Becky.
Enter Becky. That was a prayer answered, divine intervention. That was God reaching down, touching me, telling me he loved me in spite of all that happened to me. He loved me. He sent me not only somebody love, but to honor and cherish and appreciate, and somebody to find inspiration and courage from.
And somebody who would ultimately prove your innocence.
Not ultimately prove it. Today they still fight that, and I was talking earlier about a second horror story. The second part of the horror story is that the current administration, even after 2 generations of law enforcement, are still refusing to admit that their bad officers made mistakes.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's pretty much standard operating procedure.
It is, and that is horribly unfortunate.
Tell me how you met Becky. Well, maybe, Becky, we should hear from you now. How did you meet Michael in prison?
I met Derek. It was, It was only fate. And God reached down and said, this is what you're supposed to do. And we met, and I was running a business. I won't go into a lot of detail about that. But he and I began a correspondence. We recognized each other as similar souls and set about with a commitment that we had to do something to free Michael. Michael had to come out of this cage. So I became a defendant, a detective out on the outside, and he became an attorney on the inside. We worked together. We left no stone unturned, and it took 18 years, but we made a commitment to do it, and in our deepest heart, we knew that the truth was on our side, that we had incredibly strong love, and that we knew that we would win.
You're talking about, Becky, 18 years. When did you first meet in prison?
We met in 1983.
Mm-hmm.
We met in 1983, and we fell in love, and we got to work nearly immediately. We had a low point in 1987 where Michael escaped again. We lost hope. We lost heart. And this is such a critical point, and anyone out there who has a loved one who's wrongly convicted and is incarcerated wrongfully, to never, never give up hope.
All right, let's stop right there and then come back. Our guests this afternoon are Michael and Becky Pardue. They're talking about the 27 years and 9 months that Michael spent incarcerated for a crime he did not commit. If you want to read more about this, there is a book which could actually help you if you've got somebody who's been wrongly convicted. It's called Freeing the Innocent, How We Did It. And you can go to the website freeingtheinnocent.com or else check out michaelpardue.com. That's P-A-R-D-U-E, michaelpardue.com. But I would recommend going to the website freeingtheinnocent.com and you can find out how they wound up getting Michael out of prison. We'll continue with their story when we come back. You're listening to True Talk 800 AM. I'm Mary Sarrett, and parts of our show this afternoon have been sponsored by Agape Home Mortgage and Alexander's Chrysler. We have more True Talk on the way. Hey, don't miss the Healthy Church Pastors Conference. Guest speaker and keynote speaker H.P. London of Focus on the Family, coming up May 31st and June 1st and 2nd. Find inspiration and the tools needed to deal with challenging issues, both in the church and in your private life. For reservations, call 503-760-6272, presented by Portland Central Church of the Nazarene, Mission Portland, KTVQ, and True Talk.
Hi, Tom Donovan here for Accent Vertical. You know, I'm the morning host on KTVQ's sister station, The Fish, and maybe you've seen me on the weekend weather on News Channel 8. As a weatherman, you know, the first thing you do when you make forecasts is you go to the window and look at the weather. Well, the window coverings haven't been looking too great at my place lately, so that makes that a little painful. So I'm getting together with Accent Verticals. I can't wait because I've seen the window coverings here at the station from Accent Verticals, and they look fantastic. Of course, you're going to love this fact. It's a local product made right here in Portland. Highest quality window coverings, whether it's verticals, lid blinds, cellular shades. The missus wants the plantation shutters. That's what we're going for. Every one of them has a lifetime warranty as long as you're living in your home. Your window coverings are covered. Get it? Yeah. But what really separates Accent Verticals from the rest is the level of service you get. From the time you call them to the rare instance you might need some service, they'll give you the confidence that your window coverings will always be taken care of. Call now for your free in-home consultation. See how easy it is to make your windows look beautiful. 503-663-9558. They will come to you. Accent Vertical.
True Talk. Listen for the True Talk magazine with Lou Davies. Weekday mornings at 10 on True Talk 800 AM.
Got access to a computer? Why not work at home? Online. Learn more on the web at incomeathome.com.
Before taking advantage of this work-from-home system, I've been in the fire department for 23 years. Within 3 short months of working this online system, I was making as much part-time as I was on my full-time job, and within 9 months, I doubled my income. I've never been more excited about the future.
Did you know the average commuter in North America spends 42 minutes a day in traffic? Why not stop the commute? Learn more online at incomeathome.com.
I was just looking for a way to make an extra few $100 a month working part-time from home around my family's schedule. My background is in dentistry, but a 9-to-5 job with a boss was just not an option, so finding this online system was definitely the answer. In my very first month in this business, I earned more part-time than I did working full-time in a dental office. I'm so thankful I'm able to be home for my kids every day, and my business continues to grow every month.
Visit incomeathome.com.
Back to Mary Sarrett on True Talk 800 AM.
Michael and Becky Pardue believed for 18 long years that they would get Michael out of prison after he was wrongfully convicted of a murder. Welcome back. I'm Mary Sarrett. It's 3:34. Happy to have you here on True Talk 800 AM. On this date, 1973, at 17 years old, Michael Pardue walked into a police station in Alabama to talk about a stolen vehicle. He wound up being convicted of a crime, a gruesome murder, and wound up going to prison. He escaped 3 times, met Becky. Becky and Michael decided that they would get him out. So the two of you, what was it that you would do to try to prove his innocence?
Well, I began, we didn't know, neither one of us knew much about the law. Certainly, I didn't, and I didn't know at that naive age that police lie, prosecutors create and manufacture evidence.
Mm-hmm.
They hide exculpatory evidence. I didn't know those things, but I learned very quickly that, in fact, they do those things to secure a conviction against the innocent. And we just began to put our case together. We worked and we worked and we worked. Michael became a lawyer, a darn good lawyer. We filed our own petition. We didn't have money. I mortgaged my home, but that money goes very quickly. And we filed, Michael wrote in longhand on a yellow legal pad, a habeas corpus, that without even a hearing, it threw out every single one of the cases against him from 1973. And we were elated. We had won. We had won. And we went back to court together. I had Michael's coming home clothes in my car, thinking that Michael would be giving a resounding apology and told to go home. In fact, what happened is the state of Alabama relied on the three escapes, called him a habitual offender, and sentenced him once again to life without the possibility of parole.
No.
Once the murders were gone for running away from a place he should have never been.
So they're admitting he shouldn't have been there in the first place, but they're saying because he ran away from a place he shouldn't have been in, he's got to stay in jail for the rest of his life?
Life without parole.
This is insane. You must have gone out of your mind.
We nearly died. It nearly killed us. And then... We bounced back because, again, we said, and this is perhaps naive, perhaps something else, but we said, this is America. This should not happen in America, and we will fight, and we will be free. We will be free. And our love is and was and is so deep and passionate, and we have a very strong faith in the truth. And we said, okay, we'll continue to fight. At that point, we got a front page story in the New York Times. We got a wonderful story in People Magazine. Dateline did a piece. And we were able to find some good firms that would represent us for free. We continued to do the greatest part of the legal work on our own. And we got people from around the globe, people in France, people in Germany, all over this country, writing letters. I put up a billboard in the capital of Alabama, right in front of the Alabama Supreme Court building, that said wrongfully convicted since 1973. We did everything we could, and finally the state just crumbled. The day they released Michael, they said we can no longer. What did they say, Michael?
The state of Alabama can no longer give the appearance of persecuting a man for crimes it cannot prove he's guilty of.
And they let him go.
Tell me about the day you got news he would be released.
That day was probably one of the most emotionally rollercoasteric type, catamaristic.
Bizarre.
Now, this was how long after you were told that even though we know you didn't commit the crime, you're still staying in jail?
4 years.
4 years after that?
6 years. Yeah.
Oh,
they admitted that they couldn't prosecute me or have any evidence of me committing a murder in 1995. The day that we were released was February 15th, 2001.
Oh, my.
And they fought it right up to the very last instant. As a matter of fact, they put off the hearing and canceled it on the 14th. And then at the 11th hour on the of the 14th, they said, okay, we'll go ahead with it tomorrow. It'll be done at 10 a.m. Well, it wound up being nearly 2 p.m., and instead of me walking out of the courthouse, in which media from around the world was there, a French writer was there, family, friends, just a tremendous amount of media, they ordered me released from prison. The prison immediately threw me in a prison van and took me straight back to Holman, where I began my incarceration, and put me under double maximum security because I was not supposed to be there. They couldn't let me go to population because I was technically a free man.
This is just more horrible than you can even imagine. This is America.
We actually feared for his life. I had an absolute pounding fear that they would kill Michael. Had he spent the night, had they held him over the weekend on death row in Holman Prison, because they were furious that we had won.
Mm-hmm.
After this fight, we had won. They were furious. I did not think he would come out of there alive.
What happened was we had one attorney who had been fighting for us for 6 years, free. She just took the case on herself. fought it for tooth and nail. Turns out that one of the members of her law firm happened to be the lieutenant governor of Alabama. And she called him and said, look, this is what they've done. This is wrong. We're afraid they might try to kill him tonight or have somebody hurt him. That man made one phone call, and everybody's been calling the prison commissioner all day. And he was unavailable. He was out of town and all that. But the lieutenant governor of Alabama made one phone call while our attorney, Barry Johnson, was on hold, and the commissioner was suddenly available.
Well, it's not what you know, then. I guess it's who you know.
The lieutenant governor said, let him go, and I was free in 30 minutes, but not from prison. They loaded me in a private car, took me out of prison, took me up on the side of a road away from prison, went to down where my wife was with the media, because they'd ran them off of state property with threats of arresting all of them, the media, my wife, my friends, and went down to the motel about a mile away and said, look, in 30 minutes, you come alone, back up here, and we will release it.
So I guess they didn't want any media attention.
I think that was it. And, you know, and again, we were scared to death. Well, what were they up to? They're telling us. They're telling me to pick Michael up on the side of the road. That's unheard of. And another one of our attorneys said, well, you'll go, but you won't go alone. And he followed in a van. Well, I approached the area where off the side of the road where they said to come to pick Michael up. And there he was, standing on the side of the road with all he owned in the world in a paper sack.
This is something you'd expect to hear in the gulag.
Yes. Yes.
Well, for my part, I was not told I was being released. I was taken out of the cell very hastily, carried down there. I was thrown some clothes and ordered to put them on right this minute. If I asked questions, I was told to shut up. I didn't sign any release papers. I didn't sign any release agreements. I was put in this car and told to keep my mouth shut. When I got out of the car, there was a group of police officers there, sheriffs, state troopers, correctional personnel, and the warden. And his first comment to me was, now what you going to do? And it was very hostile, very threatening. At that point, I did not know. As a matter of fact, when I was taken out of the prison parsley and gone through the last security fence, I stopped and was not going to leave there and told the deputy warden who was escorting me, who I've known for many years, when he first come to work there as just a regular guard, I said, you're not going to walk me out of here and let them shoot me, are you?
Mm.
And he told me, no, I'm not. So it was bizarre as you can get right up to the very last minute.
So, but Michael, for you to have to even worry about that in the United States of America, and that's what they do to Chinese prisoners. They shoot them in the back of the head if they want their organs to harvest to sell for transplants. I mean, this is something you had to truly, genuinely, and not irrationally be afraid of.
Well, that's the situation that we're now addressing and trying to correct. And we're having to be very careful with it because I'm on probation. 27 years and 9 months for nonviolent escape and stealing two tires, a pickup truck, and a Volkswagen in 1973 is not enough. I'm on a 5-year probationary period.
What are your probation restrictions?
I cannot leave this county without permission.
Mm.
I have to call a probation officer and ask for permission to leave the county. If I'm going to leave the state, I have to know exactly where I'm going, have an address and a phone number. It has to be verified. I have to turn this into my probation officer, ask for permission, and they give me a piece of paper authorizing me for that set period of time, 3 days, 5 days, 9 days, to go directly there and come directly back.
So you're not a free man?
No, ma'am, not by a long shot.
Let me ask you real quick before we go to break and then come back and talk a little bit more about how people can get involved in this whole sort of mess we call a justice system. Let me ask you about when you first were free and Becky was there. What was that like?
Think of your grandest, most wonderful dream. Multiply it 100 times the most fabulous fantasy you ever have, and still it's going to fall short of what wonderful and magic that was. I knew the minute I saw her car come over the hill that I was safe.
Mm.
at that moment because she represents that for me.
Well, you know, it's so amazing, and this is a quintessential stand by your man. That many years to stand by while you were separated and he was in prison, and to sit, I mean, to me, there's no greater love story.
Well, we are living the most fantastic love story that's ever been. I made a statement the day I come home that any person on this planet ever sees her further than arm's distance from me, they have permission to kick me in the seat of the pants. Well, I've been home over 16 months, and she has not been out of arm's reach, and I feel very blessed with that.
I don't blame you. All right, let's take a break and then come back and continue our story with Michael and Becky Pardue. This is an amazing story, an amazing story. Check out their book, freeingtheinnocent.com, freeingtheinnocent.com, and there you will find the book by the same title, Freeing the Innocent, How We Did It, a handbook for the wrongfully convicted. We'll take a short break and then come back here on True Talk 800 AM. I'm Mary Sterrett. Parts of our show today have been sponsored by ClimeNet Marketing and In God's Image Productions. From the moment I walked into the showroom, I felt the difference. Trinity Carpet, Window, and Floor Covering is a truly unique place. They even took time to show me the difference in the quality and textures in my price range. I'll have this carpet for a long time, so I needed something that would hold up. I found out how they can offer such good prices. They're the biggest carpet dealer in the state. Because of repeat business, they grew to 8 stores in Oregon in just 8 years. The selections are huge. Every name brand I've ever heard of. The prices at the other stores weren't even comparable for the quality. They just wanted me to buy what they had on sale that week. When the Trinity installers came to my house, they were all clean tech guys, even had uniforms on. When I told them I heard their ad on the radio, they even gave me free padding. I'm so glad I found Trinity. They live up to their name. They're not open on Sundays. I'm glad they respect the Lord's Day. I went to the Clackamas store on 82nd Drive. The other local stores in Beaverton at 217 and Canyon Road.
Ask for your free padding when you purchase carpet from Trinity.
True Talk, the home of insightful living with Chuck Swindoll. Weeknights at 9 on True Talk 800 AM.
When you're looking for inspirational books that will motivate you, think of Christian Supply Stores. With Father's Day, graduations, and other gift-giving events just around the corner, think of Christian Supply Stores. Right now at Christian Supply, you'll find a motivational book that will give you insight into successful team-building skills and leadership. It's called Racing to Win by Joe Gibbs from Multnomah Publishers. Joe Gibbs is the only coach in history who's won championships in two world-class sports, NFL Super Bowl and NASCAR's Winston Cup. Joe Gibbs has motivated himself and others and tells you his keys to success in his new book, Racing to Win. It's normally $21.99, but for a limited time at Christian Supply, it's on sale for just $14.99. There's an additional $5 off coupon found inside each book, making your price just $9.99. This special price is limited to stock on hand and good only while supplies last. And please, no special orders. Good books to give for Father's Day, graduation, or to treat yourself. Now at special sale prices at Christian Supply for the goodness in your life.
She has a license to thrill. Mary Sterrett, True Talk 800 AM.
If you're still laboring under the delusion that innocent people don't go to prison and go to prison for a very long time, well, I hope this story has changed your mind, and I hope that you will be cognizant of the fact that every time you hear someone has been sent to jail or to prison, don't automatically assume they got what they deserved. Welcome back. I'm Mary Sterrett, and we're wrapping up the recounting of a horrific story with Michael and Becky Pardue. For 27 years and 9 months, he was incarcerated. He was in prison for a gruesome crime he did not commit. And even then, when his innocence was found out, and they still made him pay and kept him in jail, and when he was released, it was with such vengeance and such hostility and such a vitriol that it's quite amazing to believe that this is going on in this country. So Michael and Becky, when you wrote your book, Freeing the Innocent, what were you hoping to share with people?
First thing is we have a tremendous personal financial debt. Second thing is we are trying to answer the cries for help that we're getting. We were just covered up with people begging for some help.
Mm-hmm.
Personally, one-on-one, we're just two people. We can't do it one-on-one. So had, my wife did actually, the novel idea. Let's share everything we did. Let's share all of it. How it worked, what didn't, why, as much as we can understand it. Some survival skills for some of those people who are falsely imprisoned. And put it in a book and make it easily available so that this way we can help nearly everybody who wants it.
Have you had any success stories, people who followed this? And
yes, we have.
You have.
We have some that are in the process right now of doing it. As a matter of fact, this morning, speaking with a young lady in Texas who the book has given her some inspiration, some ideas. The week before last, there's some people in North Carolina that are finding success with some of the strategies that we've employed. Yes, we're seeing some very good successes.
Becky, what would you say about the strategies of dealing with this kind of stress for so many years? How could either one of you have just physically coped?
You know, it can kill you.
Mm-hmm.
It easily destroys you financially. It can crush you emotionally. And sometimes, and we write about this at some length in the book, you have to pull back. Because you're not a champion if you're dead.
Mm-hmm.
You're ineffective if you're not there to continue battling. So when you see that you're becoming weak, you need to pull back and you need to regroup and get your spirit strong again. We were fortunate and lucky because we're so in love and we drew from that love. And that kept us going. And again, we had such a faith in the truth. And we just figured the truth would set us free. And, in fact, it did. Many people it does not. But we held on to that. And in the long run, here we are. We're sitting together holding hands at this very moment. But one thing we did want to say, the police continue to use tactics to build the notches around their belt. It's some very often an unfortunate political game to gain convictions. If any of your listeners or their loved ones or in a police station, and they're answering questions about a crime. You don't answer questions about a crime. You give them your name, and you insist on an attorney. You don't answer questions. You give them your name, and you ask for an attorney. And we can't stress this any more profoundly.
The other side of that is simply like Professor Richard Fauci of the University of Southern California, who is an expert in false confessions. Is juries will convict 8 out of 10 people, no matter what the physical evidence is, if there's a confession.
Mm.
So the listeners need to know that not all confessions are true. And the big criteria that separates a true confession from a false one is when the evidence that is given in the confession is that evidence which police could not have found without the confession. Not like in my case, even today, they are saying that I used a weapon that cannot produce the fatal wound. Cannot. But a jury will not sit down here and carry their common sense into the box.
So let me ask you, Michael, did they ever look for the real killer?
We know, and we have told them. We have told them who we believe did it, showed them chapter and verse of the evidence that we've accumulated that indicates them as the possible suspects, and they're not interested.
Well, they're not interested because they've got more of a bone to pick with you and a vendetta against you because you made them look bad.
Well, it's that, plus it's politics.
Mm-hmm.
See, we have got to get politics out of our criminal justice system.
How do we do that?
How do we do that? First is make it a no political issue about crime and punishment. Those are moral points. That's to be dealt with within the community, not by a politician, not by a judge. That judge, if he's sitting up there knowing that he's going to get 60% of the electoral vote, if he sits up there and says, everybody commits a crime in your community, I'm going to see they go to prison forever.
Well, that's what they're doing now, and everyone goes, here, here, that's great, well,
right.
That's wonderful. And you know what? I just want to say, I want to bang their heads together and say,
right,
you idiot.
For all those people out there that are listening to us right this moment that have that belief, let me dispel some of that. It costs only $12,000 a year to incarcerate an individual. $12,000. If he is wrongly convicted, it costs you, the taxpayer, 100 times that. 100 times that to put one person in prison falsely.
Can you get any money back from these guys in a civil suit?
We are trying. And right now, we filed a civil suit over 3 years ago. And up under federal law, normally, what's called threshold motions are to be determined within 90 days. We're going on the 39th month of this case being filed, and those first threshold motions have not even been answered.
So what's your recourse?
There's only two recourses. One, to give up.
Mm-hmm.
Sit up there and say, okay, I'm satisfied with being home with my wife and 5-year probation. Or two, do the right thing, which is always hardest.
Now let me ask you, what is the governor saying in all of this?
The governor is noncommittal.
He was one of the prosecutors way down the line. He was the attorney general, a prosecutor, and denied Mike's innocence. When I laid everything in front of him, he turned away from us years ago. So now he's silent. He's mute on the point.
Well, it makes him look bad.
It does.
Well, here's what we're, the second point of what I was saying earlier, is that our mission is, since nobody's making the admission that the Lederos made, since there's nobody in politics today that is in a prosecutorial role that's admitting that there were errors or could have been errors, we are in the process in our federal suit, which is different from most, is we're not interested in just money.
Mm-hmm.
We're interested in seeing those people who committed felonies be prosecuted for those felonies and incarcerated themselves.
How widespread do you think it is? Should people just say, oh, I don't have to worry about that. I'm in Oregon. All those people are down in Alabama.
All right. They recently released a lady in Virginia for that. There was a case in Oklahoma recently that was released. There's one in Florida that was released. There was one in California that was recently released. This has to do not with states or geographics. It has to do with a bad cop or a bad prosecutor. Now, if you've got any group of people, if you've got 100,000 people in this community, what's the probability that one or two of them are going to be bad? Quite high. So any place in this country that has a prosecutor office and has a police force that's more than 5 people in either one of them, there is a potential there.
Real quick before we have to go, last words of advice for people hearing the story.
First and foremost, do your part. Always by doing the right thing. Never do something bad to answer something bad.
Mm.
If a cop does something bad to you, don't strike him. Go to court.
Mm-hmm.
If you're picked to sit on a jury, look deeper than what the prosecutor says. Don't automatically infer that because a man's indicted or a man comes to trial that he's guilty.
Yes.
Go in there with an open mind and know this. There is one piece of evidence that most prosecutors rely on most heavily, and it's the one thing that juries need to question the most, and that's a confession.
Well, I want to thank you both for sharing your story and say God bless both of you and protect you, and I hope you win a pile of money. And more important than that, I hope you win the vindication that you so deeply deserve.
Thank you very much.
Michael,
we appreciate it so much.
Michael and Becky Pardue, go to their website and freetheinnocent.com. Read all about it. Thanks a lot, you guys. Well, there you go. Good old U.S. of A. That can happen, huh? Let's make sure it doesn't. Tomorrow we'll be back at 2:00. Thanks for listening. We'll see you then.